As the Philadelphia Museum of Art opens a retrospective of the iconic 20th century fine art photographer Lee Miller, we speak with her son, Anthony Penrose. David Patrick Stearns profiles the legendary composer and conductor Pierre Boulez. Orchestra 2001 performs his Le Marteau sans Maître concerts this weekend. As preparations heighten for Philadelphia's annual Academy Ball, Susan Lewis takes a look at the Grand Old Lady of Locust Street, and Jason Pfeiffer reports on the Arden Theatre's latest production, Wittenberg, a new comedic retelling of the 16th century Protestant Reformation. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
In his book, The Art of Lee Miller, Mark Howard Booth calls Miller one of the most original and ambitious photographic artists of the 20th century. Her photographs include intriguing images of unusual perspective and style, penetrating portraits, and powerful war photographs. But she lived on both sides of the camera, and her life's journey is as captivating as her work. Born in Poughkeepsie, New York, she was frequently photographed by her father, an amateur photographer, and went on to a modeling career in New York and then Paris. There she modeled for the fashion world and artists of the time, including Picasso and Man Ray, while becoming a prominent surrealist photographer in her own right. In the mid-1930s, she lived briefly in Egypt with her first husband. She later met and married English painter Roland Penrose and moved to London in 1939. As one of only six accredited women war correspondents during World War II, she photographed powerful and grisly scenes from combat as well as the death camps. After the war, Miller lived in England, where she had a son with her second husband. There, she let her creative energy loose in the kitchen, becoming a cordon bleu cook and designing surrealist banquets. Oddly, Lee Miller's son, Anthony Penrose, who now runs the Lee Miller Archive, knew little of her roles as an acclaimed model and photojournalist until after her death, as he explained to me earlier this week.
I knew nothing of Lee Miller's career when she was my mum. But a few weeks after she had died, my late wife went up into the attic of our old Sussex farmhouse, and she found among this huge pile of cardboard boxes a manuscript, and she brought it down, and she said to me, "I think you should read this." And I read it. And I was in total disbelief because it was Lee Miller's account of the Siege of San Marlo. And I could not believe that the woman that I had known had written prose that was so utterly compelling. And I sat there on the stairs and I read it. And then I read it again. And then I suddenly realized how little I had known my mother, and that made me totally determined to find out everything I could about her. So we ransacked the whole attic, we got out all the boxes, we took them apart, we found something like 60,000 negatives, countless pages of manuscripts, letters, contact prints, beautiful vintage prints, many of which are in the exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and that allowed me to piece together the secret life of Lee Miller.
And it wasn't just photographs. This was, if I can use the phrase, she was something of a Renaissance woman. Given the time that she was alive, this seems quite remarkable that a woman could achieve so much.
I think it's nearly impossible for us today to understand what Lee Miller had to push against to achieve what she did. And even before the war, to be a liberated young woman in charge of her own career, that was a radical thing to do. She really broke the mold. And then she just never stopped. When she went to live in Egypt, she could have comfortably lived the life of an expatriate, pampered and spoiled and just playing cards all day long. But no, she had to go rushing off into the desert in very unsuitable cars and get stuck in the sand finding old monasteries and wonderful ruins and things like that and photographing them and coming home. She always pushed the envelope, pushed the challenge, whether it was physical or artistic or intellectual or what. She just wasn't happy sitting still.
As you were growing up, at what point did you realize that your mom was different from the other moms at school?
I guess, really, it dawned on me slowly. You see, I lived in a very isolated life. We lived in a small Sussex farmhouse. It wasn't really, I wasn't the kind of kid that went to visit other families and other parents and so on. So I guess I was about 12, maybe even later, before it suddenly dawned on me that not everybody's family setup was similar to mine.
Including trips to the south of France to go and stay with Uncle Pablo Picasso.
Well, yes, I mean, it sounds very pretentious, but I did not really understand that going and visiting Picasso in the school holidays was something particularly unusual until one day I mentioned it when I'd gotten back to school. I was quite astonished that people were so surprised. I thought, well, gosh, doesn't everybody do things like that? And, you know, it's in retrospect that I realize what an incredibly privileged life and what incredibly privileged access I had at this time.
Why do you think her work is resonating so strongly these days? This show that's at the Philadelphia Museum of Art has just completed a very successful run also in London.
It's very interesting in that our biggest sector of people who visit our exhibitions are 18 to 25 in age. And I find this absolutely wonderfully exciting because to me it means that Lee's work is still relevant today. And I think what makes it relevant is a number of elements. Running through it tirelessly, there is her surrealist theme, the way that she has of finding the marvelous in the ordinary, of finding unexpected things and presenting us with them. But also there is this hugely important social conscience. And she was a great champion of finding the marvelous in ordinary people and respecting that. So particularly when you look at her war work, you will find that there are very few pictures of generals, almost no pictures of politicians, but there are mostly pictures of children and civilians and displaced people and prisoners and soldiers and the guys who were really doing it. Not the people that were orchestrating it, but the people who were up the sharp end doing it. And I think it's people respond to the realness and the immediacy and the felt sense that one sees in Lee's work, the way she really identified with the people whose photographs she was taking.
Anthony Penrose. A retrospective of Lee Miller's work is at the Philadelphia Museum of Art through April 27th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Those exotic sounds are Orchestra 2001 rehearsing a piece that put classical music into a new orbit some half century ago, but won't have been heard in Philadelphia until this weekend. Philadelphia Inquirer music critic David Patrick Stearns caught up with the group at the beginning of an intensive 10-rehearsal odyssey with Pierre Boulez's Le Marteau sans Maître, a piece that composer Igor Stravinsky said was the only truly significant work of its time.
Sometimes I hear a little jazz. Here and there, it's Ravel at his most abstract. There are echoes of Schoenberg's phantasmagorical song cycle Pierrot Lunaire. With all the music's interlocking details, Orchestra 2001 hears a lot of work ahead in a piece that needs to be heard in person to be believed, says artistic director James Freeman and flutist Krista Jennings.
You know, I had always heard about this piece, and when I'd listened to it, I'd close my eyes and think, wait a minute, I can't even figure this out. And even when you get a score to the piece and start listening to a CD, wait a minute, I can't follow this. This is the first piece I know of that I can't really follow. And I'm really thrilled that we're doing it.
You see the breath between people and you see the physical gestures in addition to hearing it, so it makes it much more human.
From libraries to CD stores, you'll find Le Marteau classified under chamber music, orchestral music, and song cycles, the latter because three of the movements are musical settings of menacing, surreal poems by René Char. It's all and none of these things. The composer, who is now 82 and considered one of the great figures in modern music, recalls that at the time he composed the piece some 50 years ago, He had left behind the strictly ordered world of serial composition and had become fascinated with what we now call world music, field recordings from Bali to Africa. Speaking with me last week in New York City, Boulez wasn't one to contradict most impressions of his work, but he wouldn't let me get away with saying jazz is a specific part of the mix.
It comes for me much more from Africa than from jazz, as a matter of fact. I knew an anthropologist who was a specialist in African music, and therefore it was very interesting for me to learn about the musical, sort of rhythmical sequences especially. And there were some initiatic ceremonies which were very interesting.
The word frequently heard to describe Le Marteau at the Orchestra 2001 rehearsal was sexy. Yeah, sexy, says both conductor Freeman and flutist Jennings.
Absolutely. That movement that we were just playing is incredibly sexy, I think.
We were talking about the sexiness in well, there's the alto flute, of course, which has, you know, supposed to have this sort of deep, dark sound. But yeah, the idea of the flutter tongue and all the percussive elements.
Perhaps the biggest barrier for the listening public is the need to figure out the music. That's never been the point. Even Igor Stravinsky said that he loved Le Marteau simply because he likes to listen to it. I mean, how can you figure it out when the sung section has lines like, "The pendulum casts its load of granite in reverse"? Here's how Orchestra 2001 singer Frida Herseth interprets these things.
When you read the poetry, of course, you don't think, oh, it's about this and that. It's stark images. Sometimes it'll be absolutely dreamy and dolce, and then sometimes it'll be very aggressive, and sometimes it'll be those ways when you don't expect it. The poems are very surreal. It's like you're having a dream sequence, and there with your emotions. That's how I'm looking at it.
Even the piece's title, which is variously translated The Master Without a Hammer or The Hammer Unmastered, continually eludes concrete meaning. And the fact that Boulez is being pondered more today than 50 years ago with nothing close to a consensus is testament to the astounding constructive powers of the composer's mind. Those constructive powers are even more remarkable considering that Boulez has led a parallel life as a conductor. Lately, he's been recording all the Mahler symphonies for Deutsche Grammophon. The contrast becomes downright comical when you consider that, around the time that he was composing and revising Le Marteau, the iconoclastic Boulez was recording a C.P.E. Bach flute concerto with the iconic Jean-Pierre Rampal, and not happily.
Oh my God, that's with Rampal, yes. That was a kind of like the horse ride in Faust. Because he was so quick, you know. I tried to match him, but I mean, it made no sense. So I was not very proud of this recording, I must say.
That report was by David Patrick Stearns. In a program that also includes Innocence and Experience by Alan Krantz and Kenji Bunch's The Golden Apples and the Sun, Orchestra 2001 performs Le Marteau sans Maître by Pierre Boulez this evening at 8 at the Independent Seaport Museum on Penn's Landing in Philadelphia, and tomorrow night at 7:30 at Swarthmore College. Tonight is the Academy of Music in Philadelphia's 151st anniversary concert and ball. The grand old lady of Locust Street will once again fill with women in long gowns and men in white tie and tails to hear the Philadelphia Orchestra perform before a night of dining and dancing. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis reports on the history of this glamorous and multifaceted Philadelphia landmark.
Philadelphia in 1850 was a small city but a thriving American center of commerce and culture. What Philadelphia did not have, however, was a grand house for opera, an art form that signaled a city's stature among the cultural elite. Ambitious Philadelphians wanted a venue to rival European opera houses like La Scala in Milan. So, they built one. Money was raised through a stock offering. Architects Napoleon Lebrun and Gustav Runge were found through a competition. Together, they would build an opulent opera house, but one with just over 2,900 seats, not the 5,000-seat hall originally hoped for.
Gustav Runge knew about opera houses, and he said you couldn't build a 5,000-seat opera house on two accounts. One, it was too expensive. And two, the acoustics and the relationship between the audience and the stage would be too far away.
Hi Myers is an architect who has been doing restoration work at the Academy since 1979, when it was decided to return the decor to its 1857 style. In 1857, to save money, a compromise was made. The exterior would be simple, but belie an opulent interior in a Rococo Baroque style, complete with marbleized lobby walls, crystal chandeliers, and statuary. Maureen Lynch, the Academy's operations manager, says there was a spiritual aspect to this temple of music.
As you enter the building, you come to an outer lobby, then a wonderful, gracious, large lobby with steps that go up to the upper levels, broad and open for people to mingle. Then you enter into an ambulatory before you get into the main theater, or in the mystical sense, where the ritual of the spirit happens.
The interior auditorium is shaped like an open horseshoe, a sea of red velvet seats surrounded by tiers of balconies rising up to a glorious, domed, painted, mural-covered ceiling, from which is suspended a giant chandelier 50 feet in circumference. A bust of Mozart is flanked by figures representing poetry and music above the proscenium arch. Aside from the glamour of its form, the Academy was, when it was built, also the state-of-the-art in function. It had modern gas lighting, heating, and fire protection in the form of multiple exits, so many, in fact, that the 1857 building still meets contemporary fire exit codes. Its function was also remarkably like modern-day multi-use performing arts centers. Its design accommodated concerts, graduations, lectures, political conventions, even a football game between Princeton and Penn. The Academy opened, in fact, on January 26, 1857, with a promenade concert and a grand ball, not in the ballroom, but in the auditorium itself. The floor extended from the stage over the seats to the back of the house. Naturally, there have been many operas at the Academy. The American premieres of Verdi's Il Trovatore, Gounod's Faust, Strauss's Ariana auf Naxos, and Wagner's The Flying Dutchman. There were performances of ballet and theater, visits by dignitaries like the Prince of Wales, later King Edward VII, Winston Churchill, and U.S. presidents. The Academy was, in some ways, a building of rich and ultimately enriching contradictions. Called an academy, it never became a school, as once contemplated. Built as an opera house, its most enduring and famous tenant would be not an opera company, but the Philadelphia Orchestra. The Philadelphia Orchestra premiered in 1900 under the baton of its first music director, Fritz Scheel. After Scheel came Carl Polig, and then the reign of Leopold Stokowski. Early guest conductors and soloists included Sergei Rachmaninoff, Gustav Mahler, and Arturo Toscanini. During World War II, the Academy adapted again, transforming its lower level into a stage door canteen where musicians and actors from all over town, people like Frank Sinatra, would come and entertain the GIs. Philadelphia artists painted murals on the walls, and Philadelphia Orchestra and Academy board members waited tables, says Hi Myers.
So Robert Montgomery Scott was a waiter, and Walter Annenberg was a bartender.
In the 1950s, the orchestra bought the Academy, as Linda Scribner, director of principal gifts for the Philadelphia Orchestra and Academy of Music, describes.
In 1957, the building had really fallen into total disrepair. And a group of local businessmen got together, and they said, you know, we've got to save this building. And that's really how the Restoration Fund started.
Also started that year was the tradition of an annual ball to support the restoration. Over the years, the Academy has drawn both local and distant luminaries to its regular events and special occasions. Last year's ball was attended by special guest Charles, today's Prince of Wales, whose great-grandfather, also the Prince of Wales, came in 1860.
He was following Adelina Patti, who was a fabulous opera singer, and he went incognito as Lord Renfrew, was seated in the proscenium box. From that day forward, the box has been named the Prince of Wales Box.
In 1963, the Academy was designated a historic landmark. In the late 70s, an effort began to restore the Academy's original look, room by room, wall by wall. If you attend a concert at the Academy today, notice the plexiglass panels on the walls in the semicircular ambulatory outside the main hall. Layers of paint have been peeled to reveal its 1857 skin. In June of 2007, the chandelier was removed for the first time in its history and sent to France for renovation. It will return in July of this year. Today, the orchestra still owns the Academy, but has moved down the street to a new purpose-built concert hall in the Kimmel Center, where audience and ensemble sit in the same room. The Academy, in turn, now serves as was originally intended, as an opera house for opera, ballet, and theater, hosting both local and touring productions. But the Academy, however lustrous its architecture, is more than a building. However impressive its roster of entertainers, it's also more than a performance space.
I've been here 34 years. Many of our ushers have been here 30 years. Some of them have married, and now their children are also ushers right alongside of them. If you're here 20 years, you're the baby of the group.
I can remember my first ballet was there watching Margot Fonteyn and Swan Lake.
Everybody just has such fond memories of this beautiful building.
Why is the Academy not just another old building? Why has it endured? In part because of its flexible, forward-looking design. In part because of its history, but mostly the Academy has endured because the people of Philadelphia, just like those of 150 years ago, need a great temple to the arts, which is still part of what it means to be a great city.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The theme of tonight's Gala Academy Concert and Ball is From This Moment On, celebrating the Academy's future. Christoph Eschenbach conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra with guest performers singer-songwriter Billy Joel, soprano Decella LaRusdotter, pianist Conrad Tau, the Blue Man Group, and host Chris Matthews. The orchestra will premiere a classical work by Billy Joel. When Martin Luther's 95 Theses was nailed to the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg, Germany in 1517, the Protestant Reformation was set into motion. With it came new ideas, religious wars, and the impetus for the Protestant denominations changing the course of Western civilization. What happened at Wittenberg before Luther's dramatic treatise is the subject of a new play now at the Arden Theatre in Philadelphia. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, with a touch of humour, the new work borrows from classical literature and explores timeless debates.
As playwright David Davalos was creating his newest work, Wittenberg, he was using the eponymous German city as the central unifying element of his story. The city was home to Martin Luther while he was a professor of theology at the University of Wittenberg, and in the stories of Christopher Marlowe and William Shakespeare, Wittenberg was also where a young Danish prince and a legendary doctor lived.
My good Dr. Faustus!
His Royal Highness Hamlet Hamlet!
Oh, spare me, prithee!
My friend, and welcome back to Wittenberg!
The opening scene of Wittenberg introduces us to the play's three main characters: Scott Greer as Dr. John Faustus, Prince Hamlet, played by Sean Fagan, and Greg Wood as Martin Luther. Luther's presence at the university is based on historical fact, but playwright David Davalos bends the truth by also putting Dr. Faustus on the faculty and having Hamlet at the school as a senior with an undecided major. Inspiration for Davalos came from Shakespeare's mention of Hamlet wanting to return to school in Wittenberg and Christopher Marlowe's revelation in the tragical history of Dr. Faustus that the mythical doctor, he of the Faustian pact to sell his soul to the devil for power and knowledge, was on staff at Wittenberg. Davalos' play is essentially a prequel, ending with the beginning of the stories that we know of Luther, Faustus, and Hamlet. The Denver-based playwright says his narrative speculates what might have happened if these three men had indeed been around each other at the same time and influenced one another, especially in a university town like Wittenberg.
It was a location for a lot of philosophical and intellectual foment. That's sort of like saying Hamlet's asking for permission to go back to Berkeley. you know, or going back to Kent State in the 60s and 70s. It's that kind of, there's a lot of stuff going on there. There's a lot of rebellion in the air.
The culture of dissent, protest, and debate depicted in Davalos's version of Wittenberg is the driving force of the play. Throughout the story, Faustus, a hedonist, and Martin Luther, a man of faith, launch into heated philosophical discussions about morality, science, religion, the Bible.
As it is written, the just shall live by faith, faith in his holy word, which he has given to us by his limitless grace.
Martin Luther, played by Greg Wood, goes on to argue for reforming the church, while Faustus advocates doing away with the institution entirely. Director J.R. Sullivan says the treatment of these kind of weighty ideas is part of what drew him to this work. While many classic plays, like those of George Bernard Shaw, have taken on philosophical topics, Sullivan says newer plays tend to avoid that route.
It's rare that you get a play of ideas that has such potential to hit with the ear of a contemporary audience. To see forceful language, people taking stands, positions, you know, using the words and the language, and that the language is the action of the play. It really connects to Shakespeare's theater, where language is the action.
For the most part, the exchange and debate of ideas in Wittenberg is communicated in a contemporary vernacular. But the Hamlet character is the exception.
Nothing, 'tis a thing of nothing, no more than such like stuff as dreams are made upon. In faith, I am but weary.
His dialogue is written in Shakespearean style, in iambic pentameter, with lots of these and thous. Scott Greer, who plays Dr. Faustus, says the writing style of David Davalos is conducive to this poetic approach.
David writes very rhythmically. There is a very clear, sort of specific rhythm to his contemporary language, so I guess it's not surprising that the rhythm of Elizabethan language is natural to him.
Despite teeming with philosophical rhetoric and a good helping of archaic English, Wittenberg still manages to be very funny, and its creator, David Davalos, sees the humor as a crucial component of the piece.
I look at the big laughs in this play as like the vines that we swing on to get from place to place. They buy us a little credit when we have a little philosophy or theology in there that we get from laugh to laugh.
According to director J.R. Sullivan, in contrast to tragedies like Hamlet, which can be emotionally wrenching, penetrating the heart, comedy strikes at a more intellectual level.
The spin and speed of ideas and challenging ideas, debate, rhetoric, and all the rest play best, I think, in a comic form.
Through humor and battles of the minds, Wittenberg explores themes from the love of coffee, beer, and sex to a college student's crisis of faith. J.R. Sullivan says the timelessness of the play's core subject matter gives the work, set in the 1500s, deep resonance today.
This debate between faith and reason, or fundamentalism versus the questing spirit of the human mind, this is not a debate that is held back in early 16th century. It's one that we go through right now in this political season. It's being resurrected again.
Sullivan hopes the spirit of the play encourages people to continue to think, question, doubt, discuss. Wittenberg humorously sets the stage for the dramatic events that were to come, both in fact and in fiction, for Luther, Faustus, and Hamlet. Though the three men's stories are not new, Wittenberg suggests that their struggles over faith and reason will never truly grow old.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Wittenberg is at the Arden Theatre in Philadelphia through March 16th. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Elizabeth Flynn, Catherine Blodgett, and Beth Yeagle. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.